This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Illinois is trying to stop a teacher shortage, and teachers leaving the state is only part of the problem.
Some of them end up getting out of education altogether, which is really too bad because we have a lot of very good teachers that are not in the classroom.
Derek Sage and other former teachers talk about why they left the profession and what school districts and policymakers can do to stop it. It's the first of a four-part series this week on Sound Ideas about the teacher shortage. Plus, Planned Parenthood of Illinois decides it might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. Mary Cullen interviews a Planned Parenthood leader ahead of the Democrats' Baldini dinner, and Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner drops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We still have 3 months until the next election, but it's the one after that, in April 2019, that will lead to some new faces on the Bloomington City Council. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with GLT's Ryan Dunham to talk about some breaking election news and to recap last night's council meeting.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after the regular and special council meetings. Mayor Terry Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks again. Always great to be here.
Before we get into last night's council meeting, there was some breaking city news this morning. Alderman David Sage has announced he won't seek re-election in 2019. He represents Ward 2, which is basically Southwest Bloomington. He's known as a fiscal conservative, and you guys have butted heads on occasions. What do you think of his decision to not seek another term here?
Dave has obviously served the community for 12 years as a city council member. This is his personal decision. Before that, he was on the planning commission. He and I don't agree on lots of things, as you said, but that's he certainly has the best interest of the city at heart. And I certainly obviously wish him well. We still have another, I think, 8 months or so where we will be working together.
If Alderman Sage is going to not run for another term, Alderman Diana Howman has already announced plans to not seek re-election herself. That means at least two new faces on the council next year, depending on what some other folks do. So how do you think that kind of churn will impact your ability to pursue your agenda, the things that you ran on to get re-elected in 2017?
Well, that's an excellent question. As any mayor who wants to be effective, you have to try to help recruit, groom, and support candidates for city council who you think would be solid city council members, not necessarily who are going to agree with you. I don't think there are two human beings who agree on everything. I don't think they exist. But that share your vision and are going to be effective representatives of their constituents, and we'll answer phone calls, and we'll help to promote economic development and all of the things. Obviously, we have to do all these things and balance our budget and all of the above. So I will certainly be very aggressively involved in the council elections. It's a little early right now. Both of the incumbents that you mentioned that have announced that they are not seeking re-election do have people who are running in. Those who have announced that they're running, there will very likely be more. The petitions are not even available to be circulated yet. They will be later this month. They'll be due, I believe, at the around Thanksgiving, latter part of November. And then the campaign will begin, probably really after the holidays.
And you mentioned it does feel really early. I mean, you literally have an election before that election. One of the folks you just kind of referenced there in passing was Georgine Chazelle, who's decided to run in Ward 2. Georgine is a member of the city's Historic Preservation Commission. She's a Democratic precinct committeeman, owns a small business herself. She announced plans to run in Ward 2 even before Alderman Sage said he wouldn't be. What do you know about Georgine, and what do you think of her candidacy?
Well, I think she's a very strong candidate. I appointed Georgine, as you noted, to the Historic Preservation Committee. Before that, I appointed her to Beautification. She certainly has a great passion to talk to people. She's already been out in the community quite a bit. As I understand, she's talked to all of our department heads already. She's done her homework. She, I think, has so far been a very good, strong, progressive voice for our community. Again, but at this point, we will see if other candidates get into the race, and who knows what can happen. This is only a few hours old, the story that Alderman Sage is not seeking reelection.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with us. Last night, the City Council delayed action on a new type of liquor license. It was requested by Greentop Grocery, which already sells packaged beer and wine. They wanted to have customers be able to drink in its kitchen, where they do cooking demos in the deli, outside patio, that kind of stuff. So what were the concerns that slowed this thing down last night?
Well, I think the main concern, actually, Alderman Sage raised, and I think Alderman Mathey agreed, or at least some version of that, is that when the way that it was drafted, and George Boyle, our legal representative, explained why, it seemed to be overly overly broad, and that could a truck stop do something like this? It doesn't say that you can't. Now, it's unlikely that a liquor commission or a liquor commissioner, which is really the mayor, would approve something like this. There are a lot of criteria under our code that would prevent this. But I think what the council was looking for was language to tighten it up so that would absolutely positively never happen. Now, but let me also be clear. Even if, let's say, as I joked sort of last night, five mayors from now decide to approve something, it still has to come before the city council. Council has to approve it. The mayor as liquor commissioner can enforce the laws and has fairly wide latitude, can certainly impose fines, can do quite a few things, but the mayor cannot create new liquor licenses. The council has to approve with five votes a new liquor license. So I think that was it. This is really something because, as you know, Greentop had requested this. Our model was the garlic press. So we wanted a garlic press type of license in Bloomington, which we did not have, where if you've got cooking classes, you can consume some of the wine that may, you know, that's part of that. Or if you wanted to bring your the alcohol that you have purchased, the beer or wine inside the garlic press, you could take it out to one of the tables on the sidewalk. Right. And that's exactly what Greentop is looking for. So I don't think there was any disagreement last night about whether this license should exist. It was in terms of the wording. So legal is going to go back and tighten up some of the language. I believe the thing that I suggested, I believe, is one of the things that they're going to try to incorporate to narrow this. And that is an organization a business whose primary purpose it is to serve or sell food. So that would include grocery stores and restaurants. That would not include truck stops.
So is this something that came up before a liquor commission at one of your more recent meetings, and this overly broad concern, did that concern come up from one of the three of you?
It did not. First of all, it did come to us. I'm sorry. The first question. It did come to us a couple of times. And we did discuss it. All the liquor commissioners, there was some public input. We just spoke with our legal counsel, Mr. Boyle, and at that point, and sometimes you're maybe a little too close to it, it did not come up as something that was overly broad. But that was the intent. The intent was to say, in Bloomington, we'd like to kind of have a license that would allow a garlic press type of business to exist in our city as well.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with us, and I wanted to get your reaction to some developments in this effort to dissolve the Bloomington Election Commission. Republicans and Libertarians have collected about 1,300 signatures to get a referendum on the ballot to dissolve the BEC, folding the duties into the county clerk's office. Yesterday, local Democrats, led by the Election Commission's chair, Denise Williams, filed an objection to that, saying a lot of those signatures were invalid for various reasons, looking to get it removed from the ballot in November. So you're a Democrat, mayor of the whole city of Bloomington. What do you make of all this?
Well, first of all, the mayor of Bloomington's nonpartisan, and I think there's a good reason why 75% of mayors in the United States are nonpartisan. And in this particular situation, this is a partisan dispute, and it shouldn't be a partisan dispute. My position on it is I actually agree with the Libertarians and the Republicans to the extent that there's too much bureaucracy. Why have two? But I do agree with the Democrats that no elected official should count her own ballots. Kathy Michael wants to count her own ballots. Kathy Michael, I'm sure, will fight this tooth and nail. She's the current clerk. She's running for re-election. She'll probably have a tough re-election. She, nor her opponent, nor anybody, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, nobody should count their own ballots. So that's why I, when I was on the county board, I favored contracting out the clerk's function to the Bloomington Election Commission. Then we changed probably the name of the Bloomington Election Commission to the McLean County Election Commission, which would handle in a nonpartisan way the counting of ballots, the registering of voters, et cetera, throughout the entire community. The fact that this is a partisan issue is, to me, sad.
Well, do you think that the criticism I've heard from Republicans and Libertarians is that the Democrats who are leading this charge are stifling an opportunity to let voters weigh in on the issue by objecting to the signatures in this way? And I realize you're in a nonpartisan role now, but I assume you're still a registered Democrat. I want to know what you think of that. Is this a stifling of voter input by the Democrats?
Well, first of all, we don't have party registration in Illinois. I have voted in Republican primaries. I voted in Democratic primaries. And I think actually most people probably have flipped back and forth. Second of all is I think what I can't speak. I heard about this from a media question last night. So I can't speak for what's in the minds of the people who were proposing this. But I think if they see a bad proposal, and I think they see this as a bad proposal, and that's where I would agree with them, is I do not think the county clerk should expand, or any kind, whether it's Kathy Michael or any other county clerk, should expand their political bureaucratic empire to include even more things. I think that vote counting and voting registration should be elsewhere. We've seen complaints. There was up to a four-hour waiting list or time for students at ISU last time around. Was that an accident? I don't know if it was an accident, but there were political charges that it was not an accident. That if this was the east side of Bloomington or the east side of Normal, you'd have had 10 election officials out there in no time to make sure that people didn't have to wait in line. If you have a nonpartisan election commission, then those issues are taken off the table.
Well, not to put words in her mouth, I assume Kathy Michael, the current county clerk, would object to what you just said and say that it was not an intentional understaffing of the site. And later, the county decided to put more resources onto that those particular polling areas. Last question for you. I want – maybe you can clarify this for our listeners who may be confused about – how the Bloomington Election Commission is funded and where the money comes from and its role in relationship to the city of Bloomington. Can you talk a little bit about how the BEC fits into the city of Bloomington from a governance perspective, how the money flows from county to city, and why it works in that way?
Okay. Yeah. Well, first of all, my point was not that Kathy Michael intended to make four-hour waiting lists for Illinois State University students, but she certainly was not sensitive in the slightest to the students or their plight, and frankly didn't seem to care at all in terms of her remarks or public remarks, and certainly did not apologize to students. So I don't think, regardless of whether or not it was intentional, there was no sensitivity or understanding to students, and it seemed like she didn't want people those students to vote at all, where they have a constitutional right to vote. Now, I'm sorry, the other part of the question that you asked me.
I think you just kind of clarify the relationship between the city of Bloomington and the BEC.
Yes. First of all, the Bloomington Election Commission handles the election coverage within the city of Bloomington, and it administers elections, but it's actually funded through the county. So it's an oddity. In fact, when I was on the county board, we were the oversight group for the Bloomington Election Commission. So it would be very easy to just contract with the Bloomington Election Commission, called the McLean County Election Commission. It's already funded by the county to go ahead and handle that function in a nonpartisan manner.
Well, Mayor Renner, thanks again for your time today on Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal.
So
Support for GLT comes from Kurtz Auto Body, serving McLean County and beyond for nearly 50 years. Auto body repair and painting covered by a limited lifetime warranty. Professional estimates with no appointment needed. Details at KurtzAutoBody.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Planned Parenthood goes all in on a partisan election stance. It's not easy to become a teacher. There are special tests, background checks, and student teaching. So why are so many teachers calling it quits and changing careers? In this first of a four-part series on Illinois' teaching shortage and education today, GLT's Ryan Denham talks to former teachers about what led them to leave the classroom and what school districts can do to stop the bleeding.
Derek Sigg is an educator with nearly two decades of experience in Illinois, first as a PE teacher and coach, and then as a principal. But these days, Sigg isn't walking the halls of a K-12 school or standing in front of a classroom. His office is on the third floor of Fell Hall at Illinois State University, where he advises college students what classes to take or how to graduate on time.
And that's really the big draw for me, is being able to be a positive influence for students, whether they're junior high, high school, grade school, Illinois State University.
The 51-year-old is one of thousands of trained Illinois teachers who no longer teach. Teacher attrition, including those who leave the profession, is one of the main drivers of a crisis-level teacher shortage that's disrupting education statewide. Sigg's career path is not uncommon. After college, he taught for 6 years. When his kids were born, he was looking for a job more conducive to the demands of parenting. Coaching required a lot of after-school work hours, so he took a job at State Farm and then Country Financial, working in auto claims. But he missed teaching, so he went back. He earned his master's, became principal at a K-8 school in Flanagan, about 30 miles north of here. Then in 2015, his job was eliminated due to state funding issues. After a brief stint back in the classroom, he took a job, academic advising at ISU.
We have a lot of very good teachers that are not in the classroom in the state of Illinois.
As schools struggle to find applicants for their available positions, they're also losing teachers like Sigg. More than 12,000 educators left Illinois or the profession in 2015 and 2016. It's an attrition rate of 7%, according to the State Board of Education. It's a concern from Ben Matthews, field staff for the Illinois Education Association Teachers Union. He helps represent 1,800 employees in Unit 5 in District 87.
We're in the middle of almost a perfect storm, but not a good perfect storm, in that we have folks who are leaving the profession. That's, I think, a growing reason for people to not teach the following year, not work in our schools the following year. And it's combined with a shrinking pool of folks who want to get into the profession, which is leaving vacancies, jobs with a lot fewer applicants to choose from.
There are many reasons why teachers leave the profession, some personal, some systemic. They can add up. Bethany Baines was an elementary education major at ISU. She taught for a couple of years, first in Springfield and then as a teacher's assistant in Unit 5.
When you have something that you had committed your college education to, and a dream that, I don't know, maybe I'm a little jaded looking back, but you know, at the time, I probably would have said it was my dream.
Baines and her husband wanted to start a family, and the year-to-year uncertainty of whether she'd keep her job, it's common for young teachers, had caused anxiety. She also lacked the certification to do that small group reading intervention work she found most stimulating, and she couldn't afford to go back to school.
I didn't feel that I could financially support my family as a teacher's assistant.
She was also frustrated at times by a lack of freedom in how she ran her classroom. In one episode, she could tell from test scores that her students were not grasping some geometry concepts that they had just studied. Instead of moving on to the next unit as her school's schedule required, she instead crafted a hands-on intervention-style geometry lesson using marshmallows and toothpicks. She says her administration wasn't pleased. That reflected on her next evaluation.
That was very difficult for me when I felt like I didn't have really a whole lot of choice. You know, because as a teacher, you don't want to just throw information at your students. You want to make sure that they're getting it and ultimately that they carry that with them to not just the next test, but the next grade, and that they really grasp that concept.
It all added up. She says it was a difficult decision, but she left for a job in retail. Now she's full-time at Country Financial in Bloomington.
I have moved on, and I'm happy where I'm at.
Some trained teachers never even got started before calling it quits. That's what happened to Nick Pate of Bloomington, a former Marine who graduated from ISU in 2013, a degree in secondary education. He thought his military experience and being a bit older than other new teachers would be advantages on the resume. He tried to land a teaching job for 2 years. He got close once, a third interview.
He said it was a really tough choice. It came down to me and the other guy, and he said basically it came to a coin flip. And I was like, really? Like, you just determined my future on a coin flip? Like, I was pretty put off by that.
With a family to support, Pate turned his waiter job at Biagi's into a career. He trained as a chef and is now a dining room service manager there. His teaching license expired this summer, and he chose not to renew it.
I always felt like I could have been a really great teacher, and I really was into it and loved everything about it. But it just seemed like maybe, you know, if I was as good as a teacher as I thought I was going to be, then somebody would have hired me. So they missed their opportunity, and it's unfortunate, but it's just kind of not something I want to do anymore.
A retention rate is defined as the percentage of full-time teachers who return to the same school year to year. In Illinois, it varies by district. The statewide average in 2017 was 86%. Most McLean County districts are doing slightly better than that, though Ridgeview and Tri-Valley lagged a bit, both at 83%. One way the districts are reacting is by increasing starting salaries. Unit 5's new 2-year agreement with its union raises new teacher base pay by nearly 7% to $37,000. Even that leaves a district lower than others. Those first few years on the job are key for determining whether a teacher becomes a lifelong educator or makes an early exit. That's according to Nancy Latham, a professor at ISU's College of Education who studied teacher attrition extensively.
That has a direct impact on districts. When you think about, there have been some studies that have shown that every new teacher, a district really to get them up and going and producing and having the impact we wanted to have, and that all that they need to do that, a district really is probably investing anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 in that teacher. Well, if that's a revolving door in those first 5 years, you can see how it's very hard on learners, it's very hard on a building, it's just on that entire community.
And it's not just the money. Here's Mark Jontry, Regional Superintendent of Schools for McLean, DeWitt, Logan, and Livingston counties.
The research shows that those teachers that are adequately supported through a mentoring and induction type program are going to survive those first 2 or 3 years where the statistics show they otherwise might be dropping out of the profession.
Jontry says it needs to be comprehensive.
So I think the districts that can devote time and effort to that are going to realize the benefits of retaining teachers and improving the skill level of their teachers that are in those initial first 2 or 3 years.
With that in mind, the union that represents Unit 5 teachers bargained in its new contract for a new teacher mentoring program. It's according to Lindsay Dickinson, an 8th grade math teacher and president of the Unit 5 Education Association, or UFEA. New teachers will be paired with an experienced teacher based on their grade level or content area. There are certain designated topics they'll talk about each month, like how to navigate parent-teacher conferences, plus some after-school seminars for the new hires.
I hope that it adds up to not only buy-in to Unit 5, that they feel some sort of a connection and a responsibility to give back to Unit 5, but also realize the importance of the union and say without the union and without a strong union, that these programs and these things would not exist. So seeing that all of us are coming together, working collaboratively, will be able to have them feel secure in their job and secure with what they do on a daily basis. Because what we do, while it's great to support each other, our sole purpose is to make sure that kids are supported and that kids learn and kids grow.
Nancy Latham, the ISU researcher, says mentorship is handled unevenly across the state.
Some have huge, formal, substantive, deep induction and mentoring programs and support, and some are, oh, there's another kindergarten teacher, I'll just hook you up, and here's her cell phone number. You know what I mean? I mean, it's everything in between.
Attrition won't ever fall to zero. Some people just want to change careers. Here's Latham again.
When compared to other fields, education, if you look at the national employment data, there are fields bleeding more than we do. Retail bleeds, of course, a lot more than education. Nursing seems to be bleeding terribly.
Another troubling sign, says Ben Matthews from the IEA, is it's not just early career teachers who are leaving.
You know, we have folks who've been teaching for 20 or 25 years, and the job has changed completely from when they got into the work. There's less time to teach, less autonomy. There's a lot more top-down directives, very little time to really do the things that they are passionate about working with students, a lot more paperwork, a lot more hours, and there's folks who just are burned out and can't take that anymore.
You can see an interactive graphic showing teacher retention rates for McLean County school districts at our website, wglt.org. I'm Ryan Denham.
Coming up tomorrow is part two of our series on Illinois' teacher shortage in education today. Eric Stock reports whether and how teacher pay contributes to the lack of educators.
What if the data we depend on doesn't always tell us the complete picture?
We divide our world into rich countries and poor countries based on these economic numbers, these GDP numbers. We're not counting those invisible things that actually are really important to us in our lives.
I'm Guy Raz, telling the story behind the numbers. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT. News and ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Still to come on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, Southern Illinois University has had a recent leadership crisis. Getting past that, an IPR interview coming up here on Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Planned Parenthood Illinois leader says her organization is embracing the liberal image opponents try to use against them. Planned Parenthood Action President and CEO Jennifer Welch will speak at a McLean County Democrats dinner tomorrow about the organization's role in this election season. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Welch ahead of the Baldini dinner, saying Planned Parenthood's goal for women's health requires wholehearted political activism.
Planned Parenthood has become a lightning rod in the cultural and political conflict across the nation, based on those who prefer abstinence and those who oppose abortion. Even though abortion services are only a small part of what your agency provides, is there a way to move out of the iconic flashpoint status that you have?
I don't know if there's a way to move out, but I don't know that we want to. I think that's really the more important point. I'm speaking to you today as the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Illinois Action, and that's the part of our organization that's focused on advocacy and making progress in, you know, with candidates and in the electoral arena and in the political arena. So the reality of the situation is that we are at a pivotal time in U.S. history, and I want to focus everyone's attention on what's at risk and Planned Parenthood's role in the fight to keep access to reproductive rights and health and sexual health services in our country.
So is Planned Parenthood's brand permanently associated with liberal causes instead of reproductive health?
You know, I think that you're hitting on a point that that Planned Parenthood is becoming increasingly intersectional, that we are recognizing that our concerns are linked and that we, because our patients care about immigrant rights, because our patients care about LGBTQ rights, because our patients care about maintaining civil rights in this country, we care about these things too. And honestly, for me, I am just afraid of living in a country where my daughters and our granddaughters have less rights than we did. And you know what? I should clarify, of course, Planned Parenthood of Illinois, the healthcare institution, they're the one who has patients. Like I mentioned before, I'm sort of wearing my PPIA hat as we talk today.
You're speaking at a Democratic Party function. So are you embracing that iconic status instead of working to change how you're perceived?
I think that we're focusing on these battles that we can't afford to lose right now. The healthcare and civil rights of millions of people are at stake, along with access to safe and legal abortion. And I'm talking to any group of people that want to talk about those important issues at this critical time.
Then what is your message to Democrats at the Baldini dinner?
My message to everyone over the next few months is that we have to, I say that we've got a three-point plan right now, and it's fairly simple. It's act, vote, win. And ACT is the first step, and that's about putting boots on the ground with our partners to do voter registration and to make sure that everybody knows how much this election matters. And then the second step is getting everybody to the polling places. And I'm encouraging everybody who cares about Planned Parenthood and the issues that we're all talking about today, I'm encouraging everyone, vote early, and that way you can dedicate Election Day to helping other people get to the polling place. And the, you know, the good news is if we all do that, then good people will be elected in the fall, and they will work with us to maintain access to health care and the rights and liberties that we're so committed to.
So the larger forces at work in this culture include both the Year of the Woman Candidate and Trump. So how do those affect how and where you as Planned Parenthood offer your services?
Yeah, so kind of switching gears to talk about Planned Parenthood of Illinois' healthcare institutions, we have, Planned Parenthood of Illinois has 17 health centers in locations across the state. And last year at those centers, we served 68,000 patients. And that is really what we are committed to continuing to do. And we know that there are still places in Illinois where there is unmet need for family planning and abortion services, and we're committed to trying to expand care to reach everyone who needs care.
Would you say that based on culture and just where people are located, do you struggle to expand your services in certain areas of the state that, say, might have more of a conservative-leaning base?
We don't, because Planned Parenthood of Illinois knows that people need family planning services all over this state. And regardless of the political leaning of an area, people need family planning and abortion services, and we want to provide it. So we have centers in Peoria, Pekin, Bloomington, Champaign, Decatur, and Springfield, Ottawa, central Illinois towns. We want to be where patients need us.
So switching gears a bit here, in the feminist zeitgeist, did you believe or would you believe there is a connection to be made between Planned Parenthood and, say, Me Too, Time's Up, and equal pay movements?
Yes, absolutely. I think all of these efforts are reminding us, and it kind of goes back to the intersectionality points that I made earlier. All of these efforts are reminding us that women have, I would say, additional struggles or different struggles. And you know, from our perspective, women have a legal, safe medical procedure that for some reason politicians try to decide about. And it's, you know, it's an indication of discrimination and I would say even sexism that women still face. And that's the same thing. It's the same sort of society that allows for sexual harassment to continue to take place. And right now, all of us are working together to help educate the world that the time for this has passed and that we think that women should make their medical decisions, not politicians.
How would you say an organization that focuses on health issues navigate that thorny cultural landscape? And do you broaden your approach in search of allies or stick to your core mission or something else? What's your process?
We, again, you know, I appreciate that we just keep coming back to that any movement, if it's going to be truly effective, must be aware of the intersections of the various identities and lived experiences of the people who are in the movement, in the work. And so we're committed to working together to strengthen our power and combine our resources and working together in the resistance. We know that we're in this together.
Moving on to another topic here. The nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court raises the prospect of a repeal of Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision legalizing abortion. Even if that doesn't happen, supporters of the precedent worry it will throw the issue back on the states. Do you think Roe v. Wade will fall? And if not, what do you think will happen?
I am afraid that a another conservative justice on the court will lead to the elimination of safe and legal access to abortion across our country. And that's why it's so important that Planned Parenthood remains strong.
We've had half a century of fierce cultural combat over these core issues that we've been talking about here. Will the tense nature of the contention ever subside?
I think that that's a good question. And I would remind everybody that poll after poll, even polls done by Fox News, indicate that a majority of people in the United States support access to safe and legal abortion. I happen to be in Ireland leading up to their historic vote to repeal their restrictive abortion laws. And remember, that vote came out 2-1 in favor of repealing those laws. I feel like across the country, we would have similar numbers here, but I think there's a vocal minority who makes people think that it's about half and half. I think, and polls back me up on this, the vast majority of people in the United States support access to safe and legal care.
That's Mary Cullen speaking with Planned Parenthood Illinois CEO Jennifer Welch. Welch speaks tomorrow evening at the McLean County Democrats' Baldini Dinner. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the Illinois Politics Roundtable tackles a whopping big campaign donation. Southern Illinois University leaders are trying to pour oil upon troubled waters after conflict led to the resignation of the former president, Randy Dunn. Trustee has named Dr. Kevin Dorsey interim SIU president less than a month ago. IPR's Jennifer Fuller talks with Dorsey about the road forward and the odd happenstances that led him to the presidency. Dorsey says his career has been one thing leading to another.
You know, I was asked would I take over the curriculum for the first year, and I enjoy teaching a lot, so I did that. And then the associate dean retired. Would I take that over? Because I understood research, I understood the clinical, the basic science, and so I did that. One thing just sort of kept leading to another. I never really applied for or sought any of these. The only job I ever sought was the very first one, as an assistant professor in the chemistry department. When the school began and two new biochemists were hired.
Dorsey moved on in his career and eventually became dean of the School of Medicine. Although much of his time was spent there and on the Carbondale campus, he says he has strong ties to Edwardsville, too.
I don't know if people know this, but my father-in-law, Dr. Cliff Neal, who practiced dentistry in Carbondale for, I don't know, at least 50 years, retired when he was well into his 80s, he taught at the SIUE School of Dentistry for many, many years, going up there every Monday to work in the clinics and side by side with the dental students.
Dorsey says it's work with students that keeps him tied to SIU in all its many forms. He says that student focus is where he's starting the healing process in a fractured system.
So yes, I'm student focused, I'm student driven, but each campus has its CEO, and I can't exactly come riding in on my horse and say, follow me. I can't jump over the chancellor's head, but I have told the chancellors and Jerry Cruz, the dean of the medical school, I will be there. If you need me, ask. You know, a big part of being a leader is simply showing up.
Still, Dorsey acknowledges big challenges for the SIU system, particularly when it comes to enrollment on the Carbondale campus.
We can't make Carbondale into a city of a million. That's not going to happen. But one thing we can do, I think, is make it emotionally attractive to prospective students. If everybody is going around and they're constantly worried, and I know why they're worried, they're afraid. And uncertainty is a big cause of that. We're going to be okay. Is it going to take a little time? Yes.
Dorsey says he plans to work with not just university leaders, but community advocates as well. He points to suggestions of new internship and student opportunities in Carbondale and the surrounding area. He says those would attract more students to the region, as well as other ideas that would boost morale. He says the university's care for its students needs to be its top priority.
Maybe it sounds like I'm being overly paternalistic here, but if we view these students as our children, we'll do whatever it takes to help them succeed. And I think that's kind of the attitude we have to have. We're not just the knowers of all things sitting on the mountaintop talking down to the masses. I mean, we need to be working hand in glove with students, with the businesses in town. And we can do this.
Dorsey says when it comes to bringing the SIU system back together as a family, it's time to call a truce.
One group is not out to demean or lessen the other. Because frankly, if we start splitting up the system, we're going to be weaker. We will lose any political leverage that we might have by virtue of our size. We're in many areas of the state, but the lower 66 counties are where we live, where we work, where we practice, where we teach. I feel responsible for that area.
IPR's Jennifer Fuller talked with SIU Interim President Kevin Dorsey. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A huge campaign donation in the Illinois Attorney General's race and the promise of prosecution of Democrats have raised some hackles. That's the subject of the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Sean Crawford moderates the panel, composed of Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Statehouse reporters Daisy Contreras and Brian Mackey, and State Journal Register political writer Bernie Schoenberg. Brian Mackey says it started with Governor Bruce Rauner's speaking on a Southern Illinois radio station and talking about supporting GOP Attorney General candidate Erica Harrell.
Yeah, he was on. The radio host was asking him what sort of things he was going to do to ensure his re-election this fall, and he turned the conversation to Erica Harrell, who's, of course, the Republican nominee for Attorney General, said he was going to donate $1 million to her, and said, he needs her to win. He said that the current incumbent Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, who is not running for re-election, had quote, defended the corruption of her dad. The governor went on to say that Erica Harrell will prosecute Madigan and the corruption. So later, Bernie and a couple of other reporters pressed the governor on exactly what that meant, what corruption meant. You know, I actually pulled out a dictionary here, right? There's the sense of corruption where something is morally unsound or debased, and then there's the other one where you're actually taking bribes and doing things that are illegal. And I'll let Bernie take it from what the governor's response was to that.
Well, I would just say, I asked him, how can you say, first of all, you're not supposed to, like, give a campaign donation and tell somebody to do something, or you expect them to do something in their public office. So that's kind of one question, although that would probably, given that they're of the same party and talking about general political things, probably get away with it. But, to say she will prosecute him puts her on the spot, but it also forced or gave me the idea and others, you know, Governor, what are you talking about? What illegal are you saying he has done? Clearly, the governor who has made Mike Madigan the punching bag for just about every political argument for the last 3-4 years, you know, doesn't like the fact that Mike Madigan has a law firm that helps building owners in Chicago lower their property taxes by filing the appeals. And the governor has actually filed some kind of a executive order or whatever that limits, you know, how much those attorneys can do at a higher level of that appeal. But he's not saying that or he can't say that Mike Madigan has done anything illegal. Mike Madigan has never been charged with anything, and yet every ad that the governor runs, it seems, talks about, oh, you know, Chicago is this cesspool of corruption and the machine. And, you know, there's even this ad that calls Madigan the most corrupt politician or the most corrupt elected person in America. So it's hyperbole, yes, but where is it coming from? He didn't really have a good answer other than, well, we know Illinois is based on corruption and Madigan shouldn't be able to have a property tax practice. That all just still, I think, shows that perhaps the guy on the radio in Southern Illinois should have asked him a follow-up question like, what are you talking about here when you say she will prosecute him?
Well, when we can talk more about Erica Harold in a moment and the impact for her that some statements like this have, but it's clear to see, Charlie, what the governor is trying to do here, too. He is trying to get his base, that, well, at least the conservative base, fired up. They don't like Michael Madigan. He's trying to get them ready to come out. He's basically, you know, using any opportunity he can to do it. Is it effective? Is it going to get that far-right group that had left him in the primary to come back to him?
Well, I think there's more than just the conservatives who don't like Mike Madigan. There's probably a lot of people in the Democratic Party who don't like Mike Madigan. Bruce Rauner's problem is that there are almost as many people who don't like him. And so he's using Madigan as a foil to try and portray that unless I get elected for another 4 years so I can try and do all the stuff I couldn't get done in the first 4 years, you're going to have to put up with Madigan's corruption. And to me, it's ironic. He can't really lay out one specific thing that he thinks Madigan has done that's illegal. And I might point out that when Patrick Fitzgerald was a U.S. attorney in Chicago, does anyone think that he didn't take a look at what Mike Madigan has done, look at Mike Madigan's legal practice and everything surrounding Madigan, and that if there were anything there that was actually a criminal offense, does anyone think that Patrick Fitzgerald would have given Michael Madigan a pass? I mean, that's ludicrous.
Yeah, and Sean and Brian alluded earlier to the fact that, you know, now Rauner is also criticizing Lisa Madigan, even though she's not running up for the post again, and by criticizing her for failing to root out, according to him, corruption in government.
Now, I'm sure Erica Harold appreciates, I think it's $1 million I heard was going to go to her campaign from Bruce Rauner. I'm sure she appreciates the check. She's running statewide. It's hard sometimes to raise money for these types of races. But does this bring her, Bernie, do you think this brings her like some unwanted attention, or is this any attention good when you're trying to, you know, to try to run and build your name ID?
Well, Illinois is still pretty much a blue state, so she has to kind of appeal to people in the middle. What she wants to do most of all is look independent. But when the governor has talked in the past about he, you know, talked her into running, and then she says, her side says, many people talk to me into running, and then he says, I'll give her $1 million and she will prosecute Madigan. You know, her spokesman yesterday said that she will investigate and pursue any allegations of wrongdoing or corruption and wants authority to maybe convene a statewide grand jury, but mentioned that she is thankful for the support of Bruce Rauner and many other people. So it does attack the idea of her independence if Bruce Rauner keeps talking about her as if she will be his public official that he has paid for, recruited, and is hoping will do just a certain kind of a thing.
And Brian,
we should maybe just emphasize that this is, you know, we hear a lot. I think that listening to, you know, my colleagues sort of grilling the governor in that news conference yesterday about this topic, it sort of reminded me of some of the conversations we're hearing nationally about the way President Trump has attempted to influence the actions of his own Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. But we should point out there are some differences here, which is that the U.S. Attorney General serves at the pleasure of the president, whereas the Illinois Attorney General serves at the pleasure of the people. He or she is elected separately from the governor. There's also a distinction in that the U.S. Attorney General is explicitly the chief law enforcement officer, right? The FBI, the Department of Justice, all the prosecutors report to the federal attorney general, whereas in Illinois, the attorney general under the Constitution is the chief legal officer of the state, but the state police reports to the governor. The corrections department report to the governor. The attorney general is more like the head of a huge law firm that represents the state in its lawsuits and legal matters. It has some prosecutorial functions, primarily at the appeals level, but mainly prosecutions in this state are handled by the 102 state's attorneys in all the different counties in Illinois.
And Brian, I think those are good points. Can you also clarify the fact that, I mean, we're talking,
he came out and basically said, when she's elected, she's going to do this. Now, we hear people a lot of times saying they're going to support so-and-so. We hear candidates often say, when I'm elected, I'm going to root out corruption. I'm going to do this. Why is this such a big deal to people? Why is this more concerning to some people?
You mean in terms of what the governor has
said?
Yeah,
what the governor had to say.
Well, I think it's what Bernie was talking about earlier, which is that this is, you know, candidates like to portray themselves as being independent. And I think that, you know, when the governor says, I'm going to give someone $1 million and she's going to do X, Y, Z, that is not something I think most candidates would welcome.
Brian Mackey and Daisy Contreras are reporters for IPR. Charlie Wheeler is the head of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And this week, State Journal Register columnist Bernie Schoenberg was also part of the Illinois Politics Roundtable moderated by Sean Crawford. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Mary Cullen. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.